Hello, everyone, and welcome to Primecast. I'm your host, Emmanuel Class, and joining me on this episode is none other than the captain of the ship himself, Matt Wilson. How you doing today, Matt?
Ahoy, Emmanuel.
Ahoy, ahoy. It's good to have you.
Thank you. Got lots to talk about.
Oh my gosh, so much has been happening. The Storm Legion and Sea Raider starters are out. Winter Core is right around the corner. And what else is going on for War Machine?
Well, let's see. Aside from the new Mark IV models getting out into the world finally, the big developments right now are with the War Machine app.
The app is the epicenter of Mark IV, right? It has the rules, all the stat cards for every faction and army, and you can build your forces, share them before game so that other people will have access to them. And now we're getting fiction in it as well, which for me, I am a longtime fanboy of the fiction, so this is going to hit me right in the heart.
That's awesome. Yeah, the app has been going through all kinds of polishing and everything, and we've got the fiction in there now, which has been super exciting because we've been sitting on that for a long time. But now we're closing in on what we would consider the sort of feature complete version of the app, where it's no longer in beta, and we've gotten all the features in there that we want players to have access to. So that doesn't mean that we don't have more to come, but I also don't want to say that the app is always going to be a work in progress. But we've got lots of plans for future development that will continue to sort of expand the capabilities and the content that the War Machine app offers, as well as features that we've committed to adding that weren't part of the original scope of the app, like card printing and desktop computer support, but those things will be coming along as well.
Absolutely. And we don't ever want it to stop, right? Like, we want it to continue to evolve and grow because that offers new things to everybody that gets to interact with the app. So, when are we going to see those things, though? Like card printing, for example.
Well, when we originally scoped out the War Machine app, we looked at it from the point of view of, what could we do that would get people right into the game as easily as possible while making sure that we had a platform to deliver the new information and content. And so along the way, through dialogue with the community, we've discovered more things that we want to add to the app to make it work better for everyone. The output to PDF feature, or what we call the card printing, is a big one, but it wasn't in the original plan. So that's the next major feature update, which we're targeting for April. And we also didn't go into the app development planning for desktop computer support, since our expectation is that most players are going to be using a smartphone or a tablet when playing the game. But we quickly learned that desktop accessibility is a highly desired function. So that's on the schedule now to get addressed as well. And then there's international localization support, which was actually planned from the beginning, but it'll take time to implement beyond the sort of official launch of the app. So we're really excited to be able to get into that. And there's so many more things that are gonna, but it's one thing at a time. And we're close to that first vision though.
Outstanding. I was just happy to see the fiction show up. I can't wait to read the next chapter of Dark Rising.
Yeah, getting the fiction into the app was a big deal. And this is where things really depart from the previous editions of War Machine and the War Room app, right? The new War Machine app is imagined as that central platform for all War Machine content. So you've got the rules and the card library and the force building and sharing. Everything that you need to play the game, at least informationally, is in the app as part of the free download. But we also wanted to make the app the singular place that you would go for all the expanded content that would normally show up in other places like books or magazines. And so that's going to be offered through a subscription, $4.99 a month for this premium content. But in addition to that, subscribers are also getting cloud-based storage for force builds, which means, more storage slots, as well as being able to access your account from multiple devices. So whether you want to access your force builds from your phone or your tablet or your desktop computer while you're at work, you'll be able to get that info any way you want.
While you're at work, I like how you slid that in there. Like, in your downtime, in your breaks, or
We
whenever
know.
you just happen to want to break into
We know what you do at work. That's right.
it. Well, and $4.99 a month, man, that's a steal. That's, less than a coffee. That's great. So, I'm already first in line to subscribe, but what can we expect with subscriptions beyond cloud storage and multiple platform access? Those are morsels, worthy morsels may they be, but what's the meal? What are we really getting? What's the meat and potatoes?
So we've been working on a ton of premium content. The plan is to have weekly updates to the app with a rotating schedule of content that builds on the setting and enhances your War Machine experience. So we'll be kicking off subscriptions this month with the first chapter of the ongoing War Machine campaign, Black Tide, which we've been working on with War Budgies John Smith, as you know.
Nice. And I love the name, Black Tide. It's so ominous. I have been waiting on the new campaign since Oblivion. I can't wait to dive into a new campaign experience. It really is one of the more fun opportunities to kind of let loose and play through without feeling the pressure of somebody else, necessarily bearing down on you. There's all these opportunities to experience new things.
Yeah, this campaign is going to be really great too. John has he's really got a great vision for the campaign experience. Each month there's a new chapter, and each chapter includes three scenarios that are meant to be played, successively. And then over the course of the season, you'll keep track of your war chest, which is like victory points earned through your battles during the season. And then at the end of the first season, your war chest will give you kind of like a grade for how you performed as a general through the campaign.
So, like, I get an A for effort, or learn that I failed my king and country completely?
Yeah, kind of like that, but with a little more narrative behind it. So, this first season is really sort of a warm up, getting players into the campaign, and using the War Machine app for that before we launch into season two, because that's where things are really going to get fun when we start tying the campaign into a league.
I love the idea of a narrative campaign being part of the league. How does that work exactly?
Basically, the campaign is available in the app, and then we'll be providing league kits to retail stores running War Machine organized play events. So the app will provide the framework for the campaign, and the resources in the league kit will give organizers the means to make the league standings visible to the store, the club that's running it. Of course, with these first league kits that we've advertised going out in May, everybody's getting a Gobber Spy.
A gobber spy. I love it. I actually have inside intel on this gobber spy. Reinhold, the original OG gobber from War Machine, is making a comeback, and I think we showed it off on Primecast Plus last episode.
Yes, we did. Yep. It was a really fun opportunity to bring back a beloved character from, 20 years ago in the first edition of the game. He was one of our, I think he was the very first merc that we ever put out there. And we're gonna have a lot of fun ways to use Reinhold over the course of the league campaign. He's gone from speculator to full-fledged spy now, and he's gonna get to help you with a lot of other things during the season.
That is awesome. And I love Reinhold, used him quite a bit myself. He's adorable. What else is coming?
The league is like paired with the campaign in the app, and each campaign season will span 3 months. And we'll coordinate the leagues with each campaign season. So there'll be some new league support kit each season, and it all ties in with the campaign in the app. So you don't have to play the league to enjoy the campaign, but the league will use the campaign for players gathering at stores or clubs. And I think it'll just be, that much of a bigger experience.
Oh, the first taste is free?
Well, yeah, of course. We didn't. We don't expect anyone to just blindly sign up for the subscription without having some idea of what they're getting into. So the fiction we'll be running in the subscription is a big part of it, and this was a great way to provide an example of subscription content that people can expect, while also providing some great storytelling from Aaron Rudell, who has contributed so much to the Iron Kingdoms fiction. But we actually have several article series planned for the subscriptions. So each month we're going to add a slate of content to the app. There's the campaign, of course, and we'll also have expanded dossier files on key characters. So anybody familiar with the Gavin Kyle files from past No Quarter magazine will know what we're getting into there. Basically, they're in-depth exposés on, on the key major characters in the setting.
Gavin Kyle files, say that five times fast. I don't think I could. I love those deep dives on the characters, though. Really getting to lean in and see what makes them tick. So, who's first?
The first character that we're covering in our Heroes and Villains series is Captain Ilari Borisyuk. Since he's basically the main character in the Dark Rising storyline, we figured it'd be cool to give a full profile on him. The War Machine app is where we're going to continue to build on the world. Every month, we'll have a major feature called Compendium that goes way in depth on one of the new armies. It's going to cover history and deep lore, how the army came to be, what it means to be part of the faction that it belongs to. And then we'll explore the technology the army uses, like its warjacks and what makes them special and unique to the army. So we went into these articles though, thinking that they'd just be a series of like expanded Warjack information. But then Jason Soles kind of went all in on them, and he's produced this series of work that I think is some of the richest, most expansive exploration of the setting that we've ever done in War Machine.
Wow.
Now, anybody who loves lore or really likes to, have that full picture of the setting and understand their army and what their, troopers are doing and the war casters that they're commanding on the tabletop, they're going to be thrilled with these. I have a hard time reviewing them myself as, as my role at Privateer, because as soon as I start reading them, I just kind of get lost in the writing. I'm soaking up everything that Jason has written about. It's a really, really great series that he's been penning.
That sounds fantastic. Fantastic. I can't wait to start seeing that content show up in the War Machine app.
Yep, but wait, there's more.
Oh, more you say?
Yes. So also in our monthly rotation is a series of scenarios that we're calling the Battle Forge. Each month there's a new scenario, and these scenarios are very, very much in the narrative vein where players are trying to accomplish specific goals. But we're also introducing mission modifiers and achievements that can be randomly determined before a game that they change up some of the ways that you can score points. And these really add to the replayability of the Battle Forge scenarios. So, think of Battle Forge like a test kitchen, right? We're going to see how far we can push scenarios in War Machine there with everything from asymmetrical setups to very experimental types of scenarios. And then we're also about to start introducing terrain pieces that are specifically designed for use in Battle Forge scenarios.
Wow, that's awesome. Are we going to see the guard tower on the table soon?
Yeah, so we showed that guard tower, right? Back a couple Primecast pluses ago. Primecast pluses. Is
I don't know what
that
the multiple for that's going to be.
anyway, so the guard tower, it's just about ready to start shipping out, actually. We've been working on it. It'll be a Black Anchor Heavy Industries model, available direct from Privateer. And it's a great piece of terrain that can be dropped onto any tabletop, and it has dedicated rules for interacting with it, like how to move models into it, how to handle ranged attacks, depending on whether or not you're attacking from the ground floor or the elevated floor, all that kind of stuff. And then in the app, we'll be offering scenarios that are designed to work specifically with the guard tower. You don't have to have the guard tower to use the scenarios, but if you want to, those things are going to pair very well.
Awesome. I can't wait to see these in action. Now I want a guard tower so I can put my guys in it. This is one of my favorite things about terrain is like moving my guys tactically up to it and onto it. So awesome.
Yeah, it's and we've designed the tower really specifically with the dimensions to be able to accommodate, 5 30-millimeter bases in the
Nice.
on the top floor or bottom floor, or 3 40-millimeter bases. Now, those units that are on medium-sized bases, they may have to split between the top floor and the bottom floor because, it is a guard tower. It's not a giant building, but there's room in there for the bases. And we really made sure that we were working towards the dimensions of the models. So anyway, I think we're going to be able to start shipping them pretty soon. And they're also going to be figuring pretty importantly in our upcoming Adepticon narrative event.
Ooh, let's talk about that.
Yeah. So we're doing something for the first time this year, starting with Adepticon. Anybody who has attended Lock and Load in the past has seen our big narrative events, like the Battle of Boar's Gate and the battle on the Cadoran skyship. These are big multiplayer battles that are refereed and usually have some sort of twist on the rules or things that you can do, like legendary feats that really highlight that narrative aspect of the event.
I can think of several. I think my favorite was Lock and Load. That was the gate, Boar's Head's Gate, right?
Battle of Boar's Gate,
Yeah. Oh man, I still have a picture of one of my friends using borrowed one of my storm walls so that he could have just multiple storm walls lined up at that gate. Oh, it was so epic looking.
So at Adepticon, our main event is going to be the Battle of Blackroot. And this is paralleling what's going on in the Dark Rising fiction. So there's some context there. So you side with either the invaders or the defenders as the Orgoth are marching on Kardov. And any players who are Iron Kingdom's historians are going to remember that Kardov was a famous ancient Orgoth stronghold before the Orgoth were originally driven out of Imrid. So there's a real reason that they're trying to recapture it. There's stuff there that they want, ancient artifacts, dark magic, maybe some things that they can wake up that will help them with their invasion. And then the Battle of Blackroot is sort of Cador's last stand in an attempt to stall the invasion in the middle of the Blackroot Forest to the south of Kardov as they hold out for allies to show up.
Epic. That sounds great. I love the little tidbit there about what if they find something to wake up? That was, it just gets my skin tingling, like to think about all the possibilities there.
So the event is going to play out with one main multiplayer table, with I think up to 8 players, and they'll be battling over this last line of defense that is covered in these guard towers that we're sending to the event. And then there will be satellite tables that are one-on-one battles. And as those battles complete, the winner of the battles gets to send an advantage over to their chosen side in the main battle. And some of that may be in the form of like allies, and maybe some of those allies might be from Dusk House Callus. So we might see them for the first time, and you might even get a chance to try them out at the Battle of Blackroot at Adepticon.
This is going to be huge. I love big narrative battles.
Yeah, this is just part one.
Part one, you say?
I got to start over because I was laughing too much. Yes, part one. The Battle of Blackroot is part one of our 2023 signature event campaign. So at Gen Con, we're going to hold part two, and the whole campaign will wrap up at Warfare Weekend towards the end of the year.
What do you mean by campaign?
Well, each of these events is going to be connected narratively, and we'll be tracking the outcomes of each event. After everything is concluded, there will be a direct impact on something in the setting that will influence what we release the following year before we start the next campaign.
So like this might affect a new model or something, like how the Grimkin League decided the fate of Holden.
Exactly. Yeah. But instead of it being a league, we're going to play it out over these three big events at Adepticon and Gen Con and Warfare Weekend. And so anybody who's attending will have the opportunity to jump in and, really be part of how that story unfolds and become a piece of Iron Kingdom's history.
Awesome. Amazing. And I love Adepticon, Gen Con, Wayfair Weekend. What a trio. We got to be at Gen Con together last year, and that was awesome. I cannot wait. I love all the narrative stuff we're doing. So it's really immersive, really motivates me to want to get my army out on the table and experience everything that is just legendary and epic about War Machine right now. But I can't decide which army to put on the table next.
All right, well, don't take too long to figure it out because the Battle of Blackroot is nigh.
The Battle of Blackroot is nigh. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Matt. I think that is all the things we had to talk about, unless you have a curveball for me or something that you want to throw out here at the
No curveballs, I mean, I think I could probably talk about this stuff for hours, but I
end.
know you got to jump and I got to jump. And, we've always got next Primecast, which will be our 1 year anniversary.
Yes, it'll be our birthday episode, so we're going to have to do it up. Later on in this episode, I bring on a couple of the War Machine playtesters to talk about some of their favorite things from the annual update, as well as diving into some of the things that they've been playing and why they made those choices and what's made them so exciting for them. And then at the end, we jump in with the Monstapocalypse playtesters to talk about the yearly update there and how it's shifted the game and where they see using those new models.
Awesome.
I'm excited. So, you want to say it, Matt?
Roll the drums.
Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da. How's it going, everyone? And welcome back. In this segment, we are going to talk some War Machine. I have brought on two fantastic guests, and we're going to dive into some of the crunchier things going on in War Machine right now. And what I mean by that is we had the annual update that released in January. And so we're going to reference that a little bit and talk about why the annual update and why it's important. And then my guest hosts are going to dive into some of their passion topics about their armies, what they've been playing, and what they're so excited to get on the table. So, allow me to introduce them. I've got Eric, aka Gonzo, and Nick Heisman joining me today. How's it going, gentlemen?
How's it going?
I'm doing pretty good.
Awesome. And so, just so we can dive into it, Eric, why don't you give us a little background about what you play? I mean, Gonzo, you've been on the podcast before, but not necessarily in this capacity. So let's dive in on Primecast about what you play and why you like to play it.
Background, I've been playing War Machine for, since the game came out. So I've played pretty much everything. But with the new edition coming, I originally, and I'm going to catch a little flack for this from my Kador players, though I've left the Motherland And I have gone it's way too cold, because I originally had picked up Orgoth starter box to play with, you know, as a demo set to kind of get people organized and play and, you know, build meta back up type thing around me. And I decided, no, I really like Orgoth. So right now I am full headlong into Orgoth, painting them up, getting them on the table, figuring out tactics.
Horus grilled you in, did he?
Oh, man. Especially after I started looking at some of the mechanics and the models and his feet, I was like, yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun.
Nice.
So,
Nick, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you play, and why you like playing it?
Sure. So I've been playing War Machine since 2010, nice. Right about when the Battle Engines were coming out. I started with Signar because a buddy of mine went to a game shop and they had two starter sets, Protectorate of Menoth and Signar, and he wanted the Menoth one, so I got the Signar one.
Nice.
And since then, I started with Signar for most of Mark IV, got into Convergence when that came out, dabbled in Grimkin, and through the back end of Mark III, played a lot of Crucible Guard.
Okay.
Going into the new edition, though, I saw all the new Storm Legion stuff. This looks cool. I saw the Madison Calder render, and I was just like, okay, done. We're doing that. Striker 3 was one of my favorite Signar casters. We're going with the horses.
Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a butt coming in. I feel like there's going to be like a butt.
Dusk, yes. I didn't know I was going to get into Dusk, and then I saw the pretty models at Warfare Weekend, and I'm just like, oh, yes. Thank you, Doug. This is your fault.
Dusk look amazing. Definitely pop on the table. Very cool sculpts. Awesome rules. But we're going to dive a little bit more into those passion topics later. Up front, I wanted to talk a little bit about the annual update that dropped in January and get your perspective and thoughts on it. I know that the annual update is really important for us because we're shifting away from doing dynamic updates and, you know, intermittent updates that don't necessarily target as much. Now the annual update brings us up in the health of the game to address a little bit of everything from everybody about some of the issues, and this coming right on the heels of ending the beta as well, so getting some finalized rules. Eric, what were some of your thoughts on the annual update dropping?
When I saw it, I was like, this is great. I mean, we get everything in there, and they're adding some design notes in there, which a lot of people have asked for, which I think is good because it, you know, puts face forward of, hey, this is why we're changing it. Some of the things that I was looking forward to being, you know, I still play my Grimkin a little bit and still my Kador, was the Naslayers. When the rules came out for them, I was like, wow, these guys are super, super powerful. And with the inclusion of Unstoppable now, I was like, man, these guys are really, really powerful. And then that they changed them up and, you know, got rid of that, because that was something that was, and it was, I wouldn't say a negative play experience, but an overpowered play experience. So just kind of toned them down.
Brought them back to earth, so to speak.
Yeah, very much so. You know, armor piercing decapitated horses are just, you know, they're right there. And another thing was including trumps on the cards. That was one of the reasons why I got pulled into Grimkin, was the trumps on the cards and pulling off the weird janky things. I always used to tell people, hey, do you want to take a free strike? And they would. And of course I would throw a card down and, you know, go with it. But adding the trumps on the cards really pushed.
Sneaky Gonzo.
It was actually a running gag at one. I think it was one convention. It was a rumor. If Gonzo says, do you want to take a free strike? Say no. And someone was going to put it on a t-shirt. So I thought it was quite hilarious. Nice. Now that that's gone, you don't have to worry about it. But you know, that was the thing. And also as a Kador player, one of the things I always ran into Mark III with a Kador player was the inability to have, you know, magic weapons on certain, you know, armies. And with them giving the Forge Seer Sigil of Power, making it, you know, magic weapon on a stick was really good, in my opinion. Really pushed a lot of things up. But I mean, the annual update, while they give us a whole bunch of stuff here and they give us a lot of things, they're also willing to make a change if it's a major imbalance of the game. Because if you look at it, we had Orgoth Phantom Hunter. Looked at it, and they did a change because they knew it was better for the balance of the game. But I mean, there's plenty of information on here that's really good. Especially when it comes to individual models of balancing, giving them point cost changes and weapons. But I like it. I like having a big chunk, because then we can go from here and move on to the next one.
Absolutely. Nick, how about you? Is there anything in particular about the annual update that jumped out to you? Anything that really grabbed you?
Yeah, actually. So for me, it was just reading through it and looking across different factions and different models, how some of the changes were very subtle and some of the changes were much more significant. Two that really stood out to me were, first off, the Rocketmen and Crucible Guard. So the Rocketmen unit had the gunners as weapon attachments where they would replace guys in the unit. That kind of always ended up with a unit that felt a little confused, where you've got a couple guys who want to go pick on troops, you have a couple guys who want to go pick on jacks, and because of the new unit movement rules, they can't really spread out like they used to. So there was a complete change there. The Rocketmen gunners are now just a completely separate unit. So you no longer have that question. And that was a pretty significant change. Like that was more than I was expecting. I thought we were going to be seeing more point costs and wording tweaks. On the other hand, Athena DeBarro, the new Storm Legion caster, she took a nerf to her defense. She was defense 15 originally. And she has a rule that gives her extra armor and can't be knocked down if she's touching a jack. And that extends to her jacks too. I don't know if you played War Machine much. A 15, 19, no knockdown caster is a really good caster when it comes to not dying.
Yeah, seems good.
Yeah, yeah. Instead of hitting the special rule, though, that gave her that, they just dropped her defense by 1 point. She's 14, 17 now. That's what Siege 1 used to be. Like, that's a perfectly serviceable stat block. But now she's not going completely off the deep end with her durability, and that's just a one number change. So I really was surprised and really appreciated that difference between a subtle effect and a major effect. And being a yearly update, I feel like there's going to be a lot more time to consider those. We're not going to see snap massive changes or a minor change that does nothing in the long run.
Absolutely. I think you bring up some really good points about some things only getting the feather touch and it being the right touch, and some things getting, you know, some pretty decent overhaul, some change to how you expected them to function. And that's okay too, because that's what the annual update is all about. I think my favorite thing from the entire Insider was actually seeing the updated roadmap. You know, it does say in the top right corner, all dates are subject to change. And we understand that, like, you know, as a business, things change in any business. And a lot of that has to do for a number of different factors. But looking at it, you know, we've got a target date for the 80 millimeter bases dropping. We've got a target date for Brine Bloods dropping. We've got some, you know, question marks, which really gets everybody's excitement up to the next level, because what could it be? What's behind door number one? I'm really excited for the end of the year for like a Horde's introduction into the game. So that's all exciting stuff. Is there anything else in particular from the annual update that either of you wanted to touch on?
In there, I like the fact that it's annual. Like, now one of the downsides of a more living rule set I've seen in some other systems is it's changing so often that people don't get the memo. Being entirely app-based with all of the model stats, and now having an idea that, yeah, you know, first month or two of the year, generally probably in January, you're going to see an update. That's going to make it a lot easier for people who maybe aren't as heavily involved with social media or on the internet to get, okay, I should expect some things here.
Absolutely. I think it creates that, you know, smooth, even competitive setting for the players who are going to play at that top end of the game. And then I think for players who aren't going to necessarily try to, you know, sharpen the sword as sharp as they can, they're still out there wanting to play and not wanting to feel like, oh, well, it's been a month since I played. I'm probably outdated and I don't know what's happening anymore. And so this definitely creates some very predictable and level playing field for players to play on.
Very much so. I think going with Nick, it sets that precedent. It's like, okay, we know we're going to have a good change coming up. You know, you don't have to worry about things because, you know, going with the roadmap, talking with some individuals, you know, yesterday about playing, and they're like, here's the map. And I'm like, okay, I can see this. It goes, is it definitely 100% coming out this month? It says, no, there's not a 100% guarantee. Because nothing is with what, you know, what we've learned in a post-COVID world. But, you know, he's like, okay, then I can get behind this and I can look at it. I'm like, okay, I know sometime in, you know, around April, May, you know, the dust coming out. So they like that. So I think that having the roadmap and giving it as this is where we're predicting, this is where we're going, this is what I like.
Absolutely. So I think that wraps us up on the annual update stuff. I think we're ready to dive into the passion portion of this Primecast. Before we jumped into this, I asked each of you to take some time to think about what's really got you excited and to bring it here to Primecast so that we could talk about it. And respectively, each of you have been playing different factions and diving into different things. And so I want to get into a little bit of the crunch of that, the why. You know, who have you been playing? What have you been running with them? What's your list like? What are your command cards? And what has got you hooked on playing that thing? So let's start with Nick, since we just had a little bit from Eric.
Sure. So I've been going pretty hard into Storm Legion right now. The app's updated. Looks like everybody's in there. So get to do all of the list buildings. A couple of things that stood out for me. Tempest Thunderer's got an update in that annual update. They got dual attack. And I've got around to playing with these guys now. And they're an absolute riot. So dual attack lets them charge in, stab, and shoot their AoE gun. So AoE 2, that hits two guys. I can kill like three guys a turn. You're resistant to electricity, so your own guys don't get exploded with your own blast damage if you hit. If you miss, you're still getting blast damage. You've got ionization in the faction. I had a game where I tossed lightning tendrils on them. So they charge in, stab, electrically shoot, blast damage, and they took almost two entire units off the table in one turn.
Ooh-wee.
That felt a little dirty. They are like 10 points, you know, speed 5, kind of slow, but like I was pretty happy with that. There's a lot of play there that I've been really enjoying. Something else that also kind of threw me off was the Stormblades and Stormguard kind of swapped roles from previous editions.
Mm-hmm.
The legacy Stormblades are very much the anti-armor guys. The legacy Stormguard are very much the anti-troop guys. New Stormguard, new blades have completely flipped that. So if you're playing Storm Legion, you're coming from the old Storm Division, keep that in mind. It took me a few minutes to realize. Otherwise, I've been messing around with everything. Calder, I've been playing a lot around with just different Jack builds. Bird's Eye reposition on herself is pretty cool. Rhythm of War and Watcher just gives her this weird movement shenanigans with an entirely heavy Jack build. And I like that Jack build's now viable. You know, the Arcane Mechanist and Signar, they may not be anything too crazy compared to everybody else, but when you've got one guy, just one mechanic, can fully load a heavy because of accumulator on the heavy and his own empower plus power up, that lets you run a lot of jacks. And who doesn't love giant robots?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So if you were to throw down some Storm Legion right now, what would your list be?
So I've actually got some games coming up later today. I've got Anson Wolf pulled.
Tell me about it.
Sure. So I play him with two heavies and a light. One of the heavies is Electro Bombard Mag Bolter. So it's just pure guns. And that looks a little weird, but his feat, whenever a warrior model dies in his control range, Jack and his battle group gets to move and make an attack. It doesn't specify melee or ranged, and the same Jack can fire multiple times. Mm-hmm. So I fired that Bombard 4 times in one turn before.
Dang.
I have shot heavies down with the Mag Bolter on my opponent's turn using his feet. It's like, yeah, you killed a unit, I ate your heavy.
I've been on the receiving end of that, just so you know.
You're welcome.
Love it.
Otherwise, I run a courser with an arc node just to spam out positive charge, because mm-hmm. who doesn't love a mat and damage buff?
Positive charge, so good.
Yeah. Rack with him, usually running arcane shield, and the other spell's kind of flexible. It's whatever I feel like I need in the spur of the moment. So he's pretty flexible. It's a pretty cool caster. Energizer is so wonderful. And then I'll usually back him up with a couple units of either Stormblades or Stormguard. I've been swapping in Tempest Assailers the Thunderers in and out for that. I haven't tried the Assailers yet, just because they just finally got in the app. Working on that. Smite Hammers. I'm sure I can do something with that. And then, yeah, just trying different solo packages. This Legionnaire Officer is just this excellent speed buff. I've used almost all of his abilities. I'm really excited to try the new Eilish.
Nice.
Because some Puppet Master.
So do you have any command cards that you are like, these are my go-to for this list?
Old Faithful.
Always.
The ability to just have a Jack always there, and you know, the odds of a Jack getting tagged and losing his system's pretty high. So Old Faithful is just great. So it's pretty hard for me not to include that. And because I've got a decent amount of units, I'll often throw hit and run in there. And Wolf has some decent melee output, so I will usually give him Power Swell just to give him that extra focus if he needs it to go spicy. In and just wail on something with POW. Originally 15, under positive charge goes to 17 hammer.
That's awesome. So what do you think this list excels into playing against?
I've played it a lot as a generalist. If you can shoot the infantry down, I'm okay with that because I just feat. If you've got a decent amount of armor, I have positive charge. And the Signar Rack, I am totally blanking on what the spell is called, but has another +2 damage spell on it. So if I need all of the anti-armor, I can just beat all of the anti-armor. It doesn't really go super deep, though. The infantry are, they're infantry. They can do weird angles, but you know, if you got somebody sitting in the back, I don't really have a great option for it. You know, masked stealth would probably give me a bit of a headache, especially if the heavies are stealthed.
Mm. Okay. So it seems like pretty good generalist, lots of punch, doesn't want to play against something that can play hide and seek against you.
Yeah, I'm going to struggle, especially if it's stealth stuff, to get to it.
All right. So let's turn the tables now. Eric, I apologize. I'll edit that out because he actually wants to be called Gonzo. But before this, I antagonized him with it, and now I'm just enjoying myself. I probably shouldn't. At his expense. I feel bad. Gonzo. What has had your attention? What have you been diving in on?
So, of course, I've been going through Orgoth, and I've been doing Horsk a lot. I really like him as a caster. Mm-hmm. His feat is insanely powerful. You know, 4+ tough and +3 armor. And he's got a good size radius, you know, control of 14. So he hits a good section of the board if you put him, you know, near the center. When I was looking at numbers and math, I was like, the Strike Reavers, when I first saw them, they were like, oh, okay, they're all right. They can get up, you know, because they have shield ball. But with feet and a spell, they can become armor 22, no knockdown.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, so I'm like, yeah. I mean, you have to take, you know, invulnerable resolve on them, put them in feet, put them in shield wall. But a troop unit that can do that, that's pretty solid for holding a zone or object, you know, an area. If you really want to push it up, you know, give them, I can't remember the actual card, gives them tough and true inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, on the feet, they're toughing on a 4+ and they have tough for one round. So I was like, you know, you give them the standard bearer on top of it, so now they hit easier, and, you know, armor's dropped because of curse, if you can get it. So I'm like, this is a pretty solid unit that can just sit and hold an area, especially in a crucial part of the game if you get them under feet. Having the ability to do combined range attack makes it really good. So I was really surprised by them. They were one of the ones I was kind of meh at first, but after looking at the numbers and crunching it up, it came really good. While I haven't got to play with them a lot because I proxied them, were the Raw Carriers.
Yeah.
I love me some Flying Cav. And with them having, you know, Unstoppable and Gang Reposition and Sitting Vulture, with either Death March or Carnage with them, you can get them up to a mat 10 and they're -1 to their armor of where they're attacking. So technically, -1 to defense. So you're technically, you know, mat 11, so you don't care about that high defense. Now they do get, you know, their armor 16, but the ability to fly, and if you get lucky, who doesn't like a critical pitch?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the army's got a lot of punch. It's got a lot of staying power. It's definitely something that you'd catch me playing, and Horusken in some games.
Oh yeah, very solid caster. I like taking him with like Windstorm, mm-hmm. with the ability to flip that out. Of course, when I go against a very big shooting army, I always like to have Windstorm on the fly to help with that. But just a bunch of those models are, you get your hitting power out of them, and you also get your mat fix, which is really good. And I was really surprised going through the rules, the Reaver Skirmishers, which haven't come out yet. Hopefully they come out quick enough. You know, ambush or advanced deploy, you know, 5-wound or, you know, a single wound, but two weapon with fire on them. I mean, POW 12s. you know, you put them with a standard and they can really excel. Speed 6, they're just very solid.
So, you know, if you were going up against, say, Nick right now, and you're going to windmill slam down your Orgoth, what's your list? Top to bottom.
My top to bottom is Orsk with two tyrants, one with the shield and the flail, another one with a flail and a ripper. Therion Vanek, Volkar Forgemaster, Reaver Skirmishers with standard, Raw Carriers, Strike Reavers with the standard, Orcar Axers, and the Warwitch Coven. My cards that I usually go through, and these are usually pretty solid ones because anytime you can give something tough or unstoppable, which would be Breakthrough, Hit and Run, Infiltration, Old Faithful, and True Inspiration. And then, of course, the spells, you know, rack spells usually change up. And if I know that I'm going to be seeing a ton of shooting, you know, Windstorm is solid.
Awesome. So what do you think this list excels into? What's your perfect matchup?
I think it really excels in scenario play where some of the objectives and flags are on the opposite side of the table or near the center.
Okay.
Because the ambushing, you know, coming in on the left-hand side, sure, you can't attack, you know, first round, but contesting and then making them tough, you know, they're tough or whatever, is really fun. And blocking off scenarios, sitting there with a Jack that's armor 20 plus, just to make sure it stays the turn if you need it to.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, like I said, you know, the card to give D6 health, you're like, okay, you took out two systems. I roll a 2 or higher, I'm fully back functional again.
Nice. So what do you think your biggest weakness is? You know, you got Windstorm to protect you against some guns, but that doesn't protect you from everything.
No. So as Nick had stated, the ability to shoot outside of activation is really powerful. And so if you have something that can hit really, really hard, it doesn't matter what your armor is because it can usually be fixed. But like I said, these are general. I like to play generalized lists that can help every situation and not specialize into one, because I think that's where I'm seeing, you know, Mark IV go in type of gameplay. But anything can hit really, really hard or armor piercing stuff. Oh, man, doesn't matter how much I have. Armor piercing just crunches through things anyway.
You remember that tyrant with the flail and the gun? Yeah, guess who's died on Wolf's Feet turn before?
Yes.
Ouch.
Yes. But like I said, it's a good generalized and can help, you know, round out stuff. And so with tough on the models and the ability to keep them going on a 4+ turn feet turn, not perfect, but it's better than just picking them up and getting rid of them.
So I think that brings us to the end of the passion section that I had you primed up for. But before we go, is there anything in particular that either of you wanted to talk about in regards to Mark IV while I have you on Primecast?
I'm actually really looking forward to defenses. I know that we got spoiled on them and everything's, you know, they gave a little thing. I'm actually really looking forward to those. I'm always looking forward to something that's going to change up the gameplay, change up things. Yeah, I'm very interested in that. Yeah, it's something new and something different.
Without a doubt. How about you, Nick? What are you looking forward to?
I'm always excited for new armies. I like that smaller, more limited army format, so it's easier for just to go buy one.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I know I am really excited, I said earlier, for Brine Bloods, but I'm also really excited to just see people getting their stuff on the table, you know, armies finally getting painted and getting out to play. I know that that's always kind of the first push, is everybody's excited to get the new stuff, and then we get the new stuff, and then we got to paint the new stuff. But after that, there's usually a huge influx of everybody's new painted armies on the table and armies that are being assembled and played through. And I'm so excited for that phase. I know it's the beginning of the tsunami that is Mark IV, and I'm excited to see it grow.
100%.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of this segment. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Nick, Eric, would you like to say roll drums?
Roll drums.
Roll drums.
Nailed it. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. In this segment, we're joined by two of the Monsterpocalypse playtesters, Rob and Shelly. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing today, Emmanuel?
I'm good. And Shelly?
Doing great.
Glad to have you both here. So on this segment, we're going to dive into some crunch about the yearly update, talk about why some of the changes were made in Monsterpocalypse, and give you some ideas about how to use them and the synergy therein. And then at the end, if we have some time, we're going to talk about those sneak peek of Archipelagon that we showed in Primecast Plus last episode. So Rob, why don't you take us away? We're going to go through that yearly update insider. So for the listeners, if you want to join us, follow us along, Rob's going to start right at the top with Jungle Fortress.
All right. Yeah. Starting with Jungle Fortress. I myself am an AP aficionado, a big fan of the monkey. So I'm real happy to see this made its way in here. So what was the reasoning behind Rampart, and what was the reasoning for leaving Patrol Base as is?
So those are both great questions. With Patrol Base specifically, we tried, you know, every change you can imagine to that rule to push it and see if there were different versions of it that were acceptable. But with Integrate Monsters now and some of the different units that can be dropped out, ultimately the playtest data just showed that there were too many abuse cases to change Patrol Base action to be anything other than exactly what it was. And so with Rampart, we knew that Jungle Fortress needed something, and needed something fresh, and needed something new. And this was a space that no other building occupied in design space. And it specifically affects rams and the second parts of SWATs. But a lot of times in Monsterpocalypse, those are the power attacks most often used to de-screen or open up attack lanes on a monster. And so this makes it that much more difficult to get in on monsters who are hiding behind them. And it kind of plays into that jungle stronghold. If you look at the card, it's, you know, a mountain base. And so Rampart really helps emphasize how hard it is. And then additionally, there are some different use cases for, like, using Patrol Base to get high cost units out in your power base. And Rampart helps protect your power base a little bit too. So that way you have different options for building up a strong base of power that's harder to disrupt. And there are so many monsters who are good at disrupting. This is that extra added layer of protection.
Right. I've also found the Rampart's a really good midfield rule. So as you said, one of the most common entry or starts on a monster is to ram into a power attack. So Rampart really just incentivizes that, especially as a midfield building.
Absolutely. Shelly, what do you think of the changes here to the Patrol Base?
Yeah, I think it'll make it a lot more relevant, and it'll be nice, like you said, to occupy that space that not very many buildings, or not any buildings, currently occupy. I mean, like you said, power attacking against buildings is really great for that early power dice. So now we have a building that might make it a little bit more difficult, and you can strategically place them throughout the midfield.
Let's have you continue us on and talk about the Shadow Sun Industry building changes.
Yeah, I'm excited about Shadow Sun Industry changes. I know SSI building saw a lot of play in early Mompoc and then kind of fell off. Now they've gained ambush. So if you're securing the building in your spawn phase, you can spawn a unit adjacent to this model. I think this can really help you get your power base up and going early game. If you have an ISB, you can swap the SSI back in order to help you kind of turn out those units. So it's really nice to see it back in action.
Absolutely. How about you, Rob? What do you think?
I think it's really cool that we effectively printed a building that's got spawning locust everything.
Well, there are a couple different reasons for these changes, right? The first was that the original ambush, as it was written before it was ever changed in its initial incarnation, was too strong. And so when it was changed again, it was changed in a way that, like Shelley said, kind of just made it irrelevant as a building choice. And so looking at those two options and knowing that there wasn't a lot of middle ground, just like with Patrol Base, it seemed like rewriting the rule to fill a new space seemed better. And I like a lot of the options that this gives you from second player. I like that Shadow Screen is now relevant for wanting to hold a building that you can spawn units in places away from your normal spawn points. And then with all of the new Shadow Sun unit changes, the Shadow Sun Syndicate base discount is more relevant than it's ever been. And I think that is not to be overlooked too. I think this defense seven, very strong, hard to disrupt building is going to definitely see some play. Rob, why don't you tell us a little bit about Martian Command Post and take it on to the next card for us?
So this is a building that I actually had run a lot of in the past. I was always a big fan of Tharsis when I first picked up Destroyers. So running the Martian Command Post is always something I had on my list. Fission's a really interesting rule here to pick up. It's the first time we really see this kind of, you know, action dice efficiency as an action for a building.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a lot of synergy within both the faction itself and then the agenda at large, and then even further deeper into the game and some of the various lines of play you can lean into. Shelley, where do you see this building fitting in for you?
For me, I'm probably going to run this in every list. I love the Martian Command Post before. I love it even more now. Resource domination obviously goes a long way when you're trying to lean into those, I usually call them skinny power attacks. And now with Fission, it just allows you to be a little more risky with your dice as well. So if that's kind of your play style, I really recommend this building. It's good to secure in order to get that dice efficiency. You obviously get the Martian discount if, like me, you love to run those Martians. So it gives you a lot of benefits. And I feel like a lot of times opponents don't necessarily take that into consideration. So you can do a lot with very little with the Martian Command Post.
Absolutely. I agree. It's a really versatile building. It has a lot of play with lots of different monsters within the faction, like Demios 9, and having integrate and being able to just be near it and power it up and get that extra action dice efficiency is just in general handy for that monster, especially early game. And then Demios 9 also has energy cycles, so it plays further into that action dice efficiency and the synergy there. And there are lots of monsters who have, you know, these kinds of lines of play, even entire factions built around the concept of the economy and efficiency around action dice. And so Fission specifically plays directly into those lines of play, but especially so Phobos 7 also has energy cycle. And then, you know, with Onslaught, being able to make lots of attacks requires more action dice. And so being able to get that, you know, 1-for-2 discount can help stretch out those attacks even further. And then for Tharsis, one of my favorite things about playing any monster with an action in Fission is just to say, whatever this monster's action is, I will get it for free. I have a refund built into my list and I'm going to guarantee it. And I like it even more with the Warden of Teokali, because if I can get a discount and then a refund and I am just really eking out that action dice efficiency, I'll be playing a 12 or 13 action dice turn and my opponent's only playing with 10.
I really love Martian Command Post with the Teokali. Providence is a really great rule.
Providence is one of those rules that as soon as I had wrote it down, I knew, I was like, yes, this rule hits in the gambling mechanic in your brain and it works so well in the game. There are some games where I don't roll a single Providence die. And it's just like, well, that's a fun roll I just wasted a bunch of time on. And there are some games where Providence, power dice on from the Providence. Yeah, like it's just pumping. And so there are some now other ways that you can compound that same synergy and build theme lists around the mechanics. Speaking of theme lists, Shelley, tell us about the Void Gate.
Yeah, so with the Void Gate, you're getting Empower and Psychokinesis. So with Empower, you're essentially trading out a unit of one cost with a faction unit of two costs or less from your reserve. So that can really help you build up that high cost unit list a little bit faster and get those higher cost units on the board and into action quite a bit faster. And then don't forget about Psychokinesis. You can move a unit within five spaces of the building. So you can really things around. Sometimes your opponent might not necessarily notice that line. So that can be really useful as you get your game going.
Absolutely. Rob, how about you? What are your thoughts on the Void Gate?
So I think the Void Gate's a really interesting building. I do think it's interesting that it says cost two or less for the upgrade, though. Was there some trouble with the three cost units coming out with that?
So yes. And specifically that it just wanted to target that range, and we wanted the verbiage on it to be uniform with the rest of the game. When you look at like rules like Empower, it's in its own way a lot like Fission. It's a dice economy, but there's some sneakier lines of play here. Being able to pop a unit up where it was not before can be really hard to predict, especially when it's just global like it is on Power. And so the hard line of play is, you know, am I able to get in something that's useful where my opponent thought something wasn't a threat? I think the most difficult thing about Empower is that you have to be securing it at the start of your unit turn to get that to go. And because it's pretty easy to disrupt buildings, it's one of the best actions in the game and probably one of the hardest to get off. And so there's some balancing factors there built in. And then Psychokinesis, changing it from 3 spaces to 5 spaces made it more relevant because this is a building you want to secure, especially with Empower. You want it to sit in your back line, or you want it to sit somewhere near there, or you want to switch for it when you need it. And Psychokinesis gives it a utility function of there's a big bubble around it. Five spaces is a big bubble in Monster Apocalypse. And that can be as a threat amplifier to move something. It can be moving something onto a PowerPoint after the unit has already gone in there and attacked and removed the unit. It can be moving something off of a PowerPoint. It can be moving it in range for your Taskmaster to fling it into. And the building has lots of synergies within the faction. Like if you think about Empower, there are at least 3 key Cthulhu units just within the faction that you want to empower into, right? Because you have the Hellion, which is one of the best attacking units in the game, very fast, great utility piece. You have the Taskmaster, which we just mentioned, which I think is probably pound for pound one of the best 2-cost units in the game. And then you have the Meat Slave, who is just has always been an exceptional 2-cost because you get another unit out of it, and it can be really disruptive if your opponent pops your Meat Slave only for you to, you know, rewrap it and make it a Meat Slave again.
Yeah, the Taskmaster is probably one of, as you said, probably pound for pound one of the best 2-cost units in the game. There's never been a game where I haven't wanted to grab a Taskmaster and put it on the field.
I think Taskmasters are in almost every single Destroyer's list out there.
Most definitely. And that's exactly why we couldn't have that rule be a 3-cost unit, right? I think you had kind of alluded to there, Rob, was that the 3-cost units are 3-cost for a reason. They're a unit and a half. They're almost 2 units when you look at like Jurors and Super Damage being able to pop up and some of the other things. So 2-cost is where it needed to be. Well, Rob, do you want to tell us about the Skyscraper?
Sure. So this building's one of the spiciest changes we've had for this yearly update.
Big glow.
Picking Eclipse and Outreach. That's a really interesting change we put on that.
Yeah. Shelly, do you want to chime in here? Do you want to talk about the Skyscraper at all?
Yeah. I mean, in my experience, the Skyscraper hasn't really been reached for many times to put on the table, quite frankly. And I think with these changes, it definitely fills a little bit of that. You could even put it as a midfield building or have it in your back line as a regular discount building, as well as the Eclipse gets you to move an allied unit 1 space, and then Outreach, especially for certain monsters, really gives you that extra flexibility with your brawl attacks. So I think that'll be really exciting for certain monsters as well.
Absolutely.
I know in my protectors list, whenever I'm running Gakir, I always try and grab an Outreach facility. So I think, honestly, now the Skyscraper might be taking that spot because Eclipse got some crazy utility on it. And I love the Outreach for the chain reaction hits.
You know, this was a building that general discount was really good, but it was just competing in a world where you were already going to get discounts on some of your favorite units with buildings that were just really doing a lot. And there were some interesting interactions with these two. Specifically, if you look at Eclipse, Eclipse stacks. It is not once per turn. And we already have a Destroyer building with Eclipse. So you can now secure 2 different buildings, be getting the most out of those buildings. And one of them, which was a Protector building. So now you're making use out of Outreach as well as Eclipse and getting to really get that movement shenanigan going. And then with Outreach, get into this a little bit later with Zor Magna, but there are just some monsters who really shine when they have Reach. Like they're good, And then there's them with Reach. And so having more sources of it in the game was good. And these were both rules that I still will think take an Outreach Center regardless of having a Skyscraper in my list because Transform is so amazing. But now as a Destroyer player, sometimes I cut Protectress buildings because it just ends up being a little niche for that one rule that I really need. And now I have some options for Protectors and Destroyers where maybe I don't want to bring something from across the agenda line, but I do want that piece of tech in my list.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's nice to have those options.
Well, I think that takes us into the unit. Let's dive into the air commie changes.
Right. So first and foremost is probably the changes to Gathering Storm. That's going to be the big one for the functionality of the unit. Resolving on hit now instead of just on attack is going to clear up a lot of confusion that I've seen with players. And if they need to hit for the attack to go or for the Gathering Storm to go off, or they can just make an attack with it and with it participating. I think the real, you know, significant change here for power levels would be the change to momentum. Changing it to the number of dice or in the attack is going to be really big, especially for which later on we get to with the Dervish.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Shelly, do you bring the air commie? Is this a big shakeup for you?
As a Destroyers player, you know, I always have an air commie in my list.
Yeah, I had a feeling this wasn't the change that moved the needle for you, but the air commie change was definitely needed. There were some weird things that went on with its rules before. We wanted to make it so that way both the units were also good independently and had use cases, and you wanted to spawn them. They're core key units to the faction, the air commie and the air commie elite, but we wanted them to not be so oppressive and kind of bring them down from the stratosphere that they're in. So the change to Gathering Storm just makes it cleaner. The change to adding momentum also makes it so that it's not just walking in for 2 monster damage with a bunch of air commie and air commie elites. And then the upgrade mechanic was a key feature that we wanted to keep going, especially we didn't want anybody to feel bad for, you know, purchasing an air commie and then just never using the elite again. And so Thunderhead helps keep that going by allowing it to spawn up, but instead of getting a free attack when it spawned, it now can just still participate in attack. So whether it's joining in an Ocean Hydra for that second attack, or if it's just now that I am here and in existence, I blast something else, it can make that attack. But you still have to spend some dice for it. It's no longer dice in play, which was another problem with the commies, just getting... It was so much dice efficiency to upgrade to an elite and to get a free attack and for that attack to be dice in play. It was just so much. And now it's much cleaner, but still very good. Like, I will still absolutely bring air commie and lots of protectors lists.
Yeah, even the elite on its own just feels a lot more viable, you know? Being a 3 base boost blast is going to be really big.
Yeah, there may be some times where you're just like, you know what? I need this good gun. So let's talk about the Coursers and the Draken Armada. Shelly, you want to take us away on this change?
Yeah, so the Courser has gained explosion and has a little bit of a bump to both the Grunt and the Elite dice mm-hmm. to make it a little bit better to make use of Pointer. So I think it'll really see a lot more play than it has been. I feel like I said, some of these models I haven't necessarily seen on the table, and I think with this DU, it'll help them see a little bit more play as well, especially in your Draken Armada focus list.
Yeah, absolutely. How about you, Rob?
Mike was muted, sorry. I like the interaction between the range 3 blast and the pointer. You're going to be a lot closer up front because of the range 3 blast. So it's more likely that the unit's actually going to benefit from it too. Mm-hmm. And the explosion on the blast is always going to be significant. You know, there's always going to be someone who's going to be bunched up with units trying to secure point. Not as relevant for Necroscourge now because of the Void Maulers, but you know, people are going to bunch up. Sometimes they're not going to have that Void Mauler there.
There are lots of times where units just need to be near each other because of synergy. And so there are opportunities to exploit that with explosion. But in general, them going to being a good blaster, moving up to a frontline blaster and making more use of pointer also helps them play in with Zybanos later. And we'll get a little bit into that when we get into Zybanos. So the Fusilier, also for similar changes, we upgraded Team Tactics to just make it stack how it is supposed to be written. We added Focused Will to it, so that way it might disincentivize your opponent from killing it. It might not, but it gives you the option to also set up the opportunity to create a dig out situation or to create some situations that put some mental load on your opponent a little bit. And then they're also just fantastic with helping trigger Zybanos' Dragonstorm, which, well, again, we'll get into with Zybanos. But I think their stock raised quite a bit because of Focus Will, and even then some with Zybanos.
Yeah, Focus Will is previously only on monsters, right?
That is correct.
Yeah, so I think it's going to offer a lot of interesting decisions for opponents to make. I'm one to take dicey, leave two action dice in the monster pool and just see how it goes. So now clearing my screen makes it a little easier on me if I take that play.
Absolutely. I really like it when you're in a chaining situation, especially in like a one versus one situation in the end game where it's your monster versus theirs and you only have so many action dice to go around and you know you're going to throw something in the way to block. Just being able to be like, oh, great, I can get one more action dice out of this. So on my next turn, I can get that extra step or whatever it is. It's that think ahead mechanic. And I really like that.
Yeah. And it can really make your opponent change the way they're playing their turn in order to avoid hitting that, for example.
Yeah. There are some times where if you're locked into a unit turn, your opponent can take a really risky monster turn and leave themselves open, planning to then screen themselves. And the Fusilier says, if you have to kill me to de-screen the monster, maybe they take a cheeky monster turn and you leaving yourself open wasn't as good as you thought it was.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we're going to jump into the C-type Shinobi next. These had some minor changes, but I think pretty significant ones. What do you think, Rob?
So picking up AIM on a cargo unit's a really interesting pick, right? Especially with the Elite having cargo. I've always been a fan of the Interceptor and Shadowgate play. You know, run the Interceptor up, drop down a Shadowgate. Being able to drop down a unit that's got a range 4 gun with AIM and... If it comes up, power drain alls could be really big, but the range 4 gun with 3 boost dice just from dropping them off with the interceptor feels really strong.
Definitely. It's a unit that definitely was overshadowed before, but now it being able to pop out upfield and take a very accurate, you know, pot shot is exactly very thematic of what this unit is supposed to be doing. And then AIM is also useful when you think about how you might use power drain, because power drain, you're not often attacking monsters with your units, but when you are, it is at really key points in the game. And oftentimes those attacks of opportunity come when the opponent is on your side of the board. And so if you can pop out your C-type Shinobi out of a spawn gate, and then it just needs to stand there and shoot, that is a very accurate gun that's probably going to participate in a, you know, it is definitely going to participate in a, you know, combined attack. And then if it leads, you're also getting power drain. I think the unit that saw the biggest change in function and role, though, and they didn't just get an upgrade, but got a complete, like, new identity, was the Sunfighter.
Oh, yeah. Adding jam to this unit has changed its entire use. So previously with Anier and just being a blast and being fast was good, but now jam opens up a whole new line of possibilities for this thing. Being able to drop it off, being speed 7 and like key points that you could block off potential blitzes, potential death gates, all kinds of stuff. It's going to be really huge.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you can really get it up into your opponent's power base, for example, block any building actions that they might have access to. So I think it's really useful in a lot of different ways, where previously maybe it was just sitting on a PowerPoint, for example, because it was fast. So now it's fast, but it's going to be a lot more annoying for your opponent to deal with.
Definitely. I think that it plays into the counterplay space in Monsterpocalypse. I know what you're going to do or how you're going to use this building. And so here's the thing to do something else. But I think it also plays very well into the Shadow Sun line of play, which is we all work together. We're a team and we fight and we all block for each other and we all fight together. And so having a jam unit that is screening for your monster can be really interesting too, because de-screening tools like Scatter suddenly become just not a de-screen, just a blank. Now you can't use it. And so there are some monsters that are absolutely reliant on their actions, and being able to tell them no, at least while you're standing here until you kill this unit, you don't get to do that thing, is very strong. And then I think the loss of anti-air was very timely, right? Because it comes at a time where we have access to Fort Ironwood, where we can just give it a boost dice if it really needed it. And so if it's up there making that key attack, it's not just flapping in the breeze, you know, rolling two action dice. And I think the Elite has more place now than it ever did before, because it's speed 7 with a range 5 blast that's a 2-1 attack, and it has jam. So now it's a switchblade unit that can operate in different roles, and I think that's very strong in its own way. Probably my favorite change to a unit would be the Shadow Rider change. What do you think, Shelley?
Yeah, I think the Shadow Rider change is really exciting. So it got hover, so it's a lot more mobile than what it was previously, as well as the rule Shadow. So basically, if the brawl attack hits, you can then move, choose an allied unit within 5 spaces and place it adjacent to this model. So it can help with the mobility of your other Shadow Sun units. So again, playing into that fast action on the SSI side.
I really like the play of being able to clear something off of a PowerPoint and putting your friend on top of it afterwards.
Yeah, I do like that tag team. I think the Shadow Rider was one of my favorite changes, because we knew that the game has kind of evolved into a place where there are more tribal options within list building, where you can build into themes, you can build into identities in the list, and build on those synergies. And the Shadow Sun needed a premier unit like some of these other unit archetypes had, where it really kind of was the glue that held it all together, but also stood as a very strong piece on its own. So we definitely wanted the Shadow Rider to be that premier unit, kind of like the Taskmaster that we mentioned earlier. And it stands alone. It's, you know, got great boost. It has flank. It's very mobile. It's got great defense. And then on top of that, the added shadows, I think, really brings in a lot of the faction synergies of being able to move things around. You can bring that C-type shinobi and move it and allow it to get its aim and shoot. You can bring in the jam plane and have it, you know, be jamming things further upfield. You can bring up an interceptor, which can then drop a shadow gate. Like, you can do crazy stuff. And all of this is ways to trigger shadow step on Zor Magna as well. So we have a piece that pulls the whole faction together, but it's just great for the whole agenda too.
And who doesn't love a ninja on a hover bike? Come on.
Right? So, Shelley, you're our destroyer aficionado on this episode. I'm going to let you take it and tell us a little bit about the destroyer changes. And you can just go from one to the next. We don't have to dive super deep into them, because they weren't drastic overhauls like in some of the protectors. I'll chime in if there's anything that's really...
Yeah, so they're not super exciting. I mean, that might depend. But for the Dervish, which is the first one up here, they're basically getting nerfed a little bit. Like we said earlier, momentum is getting fixed, so it's not totally broken as it was previously. Still worth taking, in my opinion, because you still get to pop out a Dervish with your facilitator and get it pretty far up and be able to attack your opponent's backline. But you might not be attacking monsters as frequently with momentum as you were previously. With the Belchers, they got a splash, but they got a couple of changes. So first, they got buffed by upping the defense to 3. So they're a little bit more beefy, as they should be, because look at them. And they also got splash added to their blast. So that's kind of fun, given the changes with Frogzor that we'll get into in a little bit. Could also work really well with other monsters like Tharsis. So if you have a monster that really wants that rubble around, maybe having a splash on your unit could be really helpful, because you're getting that 2-for-1. You're able to get off a blast attack as well as flip that tile without necessarily spending an action die on that in particular, especially maybe you have a lot of sun fighters with jam now. So splash could be really useful in that kind of situation.
And it's got really nice play now with the Scorcher, because you can put the fire out with the Belcher and then ignite it with the Scorcher.
Yeah, exactly. And that's definitely something to keep an eye on if you're playing against a Destroyer's player.
And bringing its defense up to 3 also helps it be a better point holder, because at range 5, it can sit on a point, it can shoot something far upfield, and be relatively hard to remove. So I think it fills its role really well now.
Yeah, and considering that they haven't necessarily seen as much play, they're obviously very popular when the game first came out, lagging behind a little bit. I think they'll see a lot more play, especially with Frogzor and your other Planet Eaters monsters. I think they help fill a niche that could be really useful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And then for the Dire Ants, they got the same update to Team Tactics that we already discussed with the Fusilier, making it a premier attacking unit for the Destroyers. So if you're using the Dire Ant, still great. Team Tactics is awesome.
Ripple on its Brawl attack also makes it really interesting as a combined attacker, because if you're using Team Tactics, you have to make those combined attacks. Ripple also allows you a little reposition afterwards with anybody who participates with it, so that way they can move in, attack something, and then press forward onto their point, press over onto a building, press back and give something else space to move in. And so there's a lot of use case for that, especially when combined with Dino, who can give them Penetrator, and they can really do some nasty work.
Next up, we have the Voiders, which have not really been too useful until now. They do have Cloak now to allow it a little bit more protection against blast attacks. And then Nullify is a little bit more explicit. So once per turn, when an attack with Nullify hits an enemy unit, that unit's controller loses one power die. So if you are in a situation where maybe you know your opponent is definitely trying to chain and they're working on that plan, you could bring in the Voider and use that blast attack in order to sap some of their power. So I think that, again, can definitely see some play as far as those denying tactics that we've been talking about right along here.
And it's nice to not have to choose between having your opponent lose a power and you gaining a power. Getting both of them at once is really, really a big swing for it.
It makes it work. We got one more Destroyers unit here to cap off our units, and then we can dive into the monsters, which is really what everybody wants to hear about.
Right. So we'll make this quick. Last but not least is the Rota Walker. So it got increased to speed 4, so it's a little bit faster than it was, and its defense is 4. So it can move a little bit better and also survive a lot longer, hopefully to make it worth that cost too. Previously, it wasn't really as useful as could have been just because it would die pretty frequently. So now with this increased defense, it should last a bit longer on the board, making it a lot more worth it to get that beachhead off.
Absolutely. Being able to sit on a point and be relevant and hard to remove, but also not making any attacks of its own. So serving its own purpose, your opponent has to weigh, is it worth removing this hard to kill gate, or am I just going to let it keep pumping out units? Which is, that's the space it wants to live in. Before, it was trivial to remove, and so not necessarily worth the choice.
Right. So now your opponent will have to expend more resources to kill it as well.
And it's even better with Zavid, who can drop it out, and then it can be useful and be in the way and still get use out of beachhead.
Yeah, it'll be very nice to have this with Zavid.
So let's get into the monsters. We only had one monster nerf, so to speak, one monster brought down. And Numitor was at the lofty heights at the very top echelon of the power curve of the game. And really was just, you know, had it all and got to eat its cake too. And so Numitor is still probably one of the best monsters in the Protector stable. It's just no longer the de facto oppressive, nobody wants to play you if you pick this monster, strong monster. And a lot of that came with changing the health split. It was previously predominantly a hyper monster. Having 7 health and hyper meant that it spent most of the game in its strongest form. And then everything it had to be able to get multiple uses of damage and super damage, and also having tooth and claw to be super efficient at hitting, Numitor just had it all. So to bring it down a little bit, we mostly made a lot of the adjustments to the hyper side of both changing the health split and taking away tooth and claw. We did upgrade it to Swift Strike so that for, you know, whatever reason, you can use Brawl and Blast. And then we did upgrade Pack Hunters to be slightly more relevant. Now that if two faction units participate in a attack, you get a power die rather than them just getting an extra boost. And the faction is certainly not short on ways to get extra boost. What are your thoughts on the Numitor changes?
Yeah, Numitor felt like one of those cases where he had all the tools to do everything that he wanted, but probably for a little bit too long on the health pool. Like having access to the hoppers, for the hop to get him in range for feeding friends, even the tag, just all felt like it was a little too cohesive for too long.
Absolutely. And not to mention the hoppers being the main way to get Feeding Frenzy, also offering Sidekick on top of everything else. It's still scary.
Yeah, just a little too efficient, a little too accurate, a little too easy.
Now, right along the lines, very almost peanut buttery in how he's built. So still play him, still get out there and rock some things with Numitor. Shelly, do you have any commentary on Numi?
Still scary to me, but not as bad. Not as scary.
Absolutely. Something that definitely got a lot scarier was Leviathron. Rob, do you want to talk about Leviathron?
Oh, I love talking about Leviathron. So Leviathron has picked up a defense in Alpha. That was pretty big from going from defense 7 to 8. You know, the benchmark doesn't seem like it's all that much, but it really does make a difference.
Huge difference.
The real big one here is picking up Bloodsport. Previously seen on King of Kamazots, it lets him move two spaces after an enemy, or advance two spaces after an enemy model has been damaged during your activation. This makes this little, you know, speed five shark actually feel much more quick and much more like a shark.
Blood in the water, for sure. And then hopping over into Hyper, he picks up Pounce. So he's, you know, jumping in on his prey, still very mobile, losing a speed for it. Like in playtest, we found that Pounce plus his original speed 6 was too much. It was a 9 speed hyper. And we were like, but we really liked the Pounce mechanic and how it interacted with the shark motif. And then picking up Blood Rage to just make him, you know, the king of the Tritons and hyper, giving them the defense and the speed and the boost die for us for 6 health. Like it's a very long and strong hyper.
Blood Rage is also one of those abilities that feels really thematic for a shark, right? Like blood in the water. Now all the units are, you know, stirred up from the chum, ready to go.
Absolutely. Leviathron is one that I think is not going to be as peanut buttery as some of the other monsters in this packet, but I still think we'll see lots of Leviathron just because rule of cool, this monster is one of the coolest monsters. Speaking of peanut butter monsters, though, Stomatovorus Rex found his new home.
I think this one's probably the glow up of this yearly update. Like previously we've had stuff like Defender X and Rastaban, but I think really Rex is the one who's coming out on top this time around.
Mm. Why is that?
Well, he's pretty much a new monster. You'd be one more to talk about how the old kit didn't feel it was living up to the expectations of it. Yeah, so the big one is he's picking up Parasite now, which is a combination of Riled and Power Siphon.
Yeah, Parasite was an interesting choice. All around, I think this monster before wasn't fitting into where it needed in the faction and where it needed it in the agenda. Previously in the faction, both the other faction monsters really wanted a monster who had Swift Strike, had a good 1v1, could make opponents care about them so that they can go and do their shenanigans. And Rex is definitely that. And then Onslaught wasn't bringing to the table what we needed, which is why Swift Strike was traded out. And then that also meant that like Munch and Vampirism and all these other things just really weren't going to fit into the kit anymore. But the healing was still important, and how it interplayed with units was where Sacrifice kind of found its home. So that way Rex still has the ability to eat things. He's just now, you know, healing and being more tanky and using Steady to his advantage and Parasite to his advantage to make it a very hard tank to crack, but still one you want to get into. And then in Hyper, retaining Ancient Power was important. All in all, I think Rex was one of those monsters where a lot of people picked up the monster because the model looked amazing and they thought this monster looks super cool. And now the rules definitely match that cool factor. So, Zor Magna, anyone? Anyone?
Shadow Step is one of the, I think, most interesting rules that's ever been printed. Offers a lot of new play within faction. There's a lot of movement shenanigans, and this really just plays on top of that. But I think she really is going to tie the faction together now.
What about you, Shelly? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it'll be really interesting to see her in a little bit more play now. Like you said, Shadow Step allows for even more movement tricks of the Shadow Sun, so you can get people, get your units into places where they need to be to either do something like use that aim or just get all those things off. And as far as Death Blossom got changed to a little bit something different. So each time this model destroys an enemy model with Blast or Brawl, after the attack is resolved, the monster can immediately make a Brawl attack. So it allows her to get those enemy units out of the way, get those power dice so that you are being more efficient over the course of your monster turns.
Absolutely. Going in, this was a monster that was on the cusp of being decent, but really lacked an identity, lacked the ability to stand out against the rest of the agenda, especially as a 10 health monster. Like, there was nothing on this monster that screamed, I'm a really scary 10 health monster. And so we wanted to change that. Shadow Step bringing the whole faction together, but also being, you know, a great way to just add some mobility into a list and make it that much scarier. It plays into tactical command and hit and run. She also picked up a defense, which makes her harder to kill. And, you know, 10 health does not go as far as you would think. Picking up Censure plays into those siphon and power drain lines of play and that kind of harass and or like remove opponents' resources and options theme that is built into the faction now. And then Death Blossom's change is really interesting when you add in like the skyscraper or the outreach center when we mentioned earlier, because you can give her reach. And then basically it's a chain reaction. Death Blossom was a unit buff before, and we moved it down to Puncture and just gave it to everybody rather than just people who are making blasts, and then made Death Blossom part of her hyper identity to where, especially when upgrading to Swift Strike, she can start things off with a big range 5 blast and Penetrator and blow up a building or a unit really far away, or maybe, you know, even hit a monster and then go into a frenzy of reach punches and just boom, 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 and level a whole bunch of units and build up a whole bunch of power, and then use that last punch to hit a siphon punch on the monster and then go into the power attacks, because that's the whole chain. And it's often a last stand, because when you're in hyper and you've made it there with Magna and you're going to get an amazing Death Blossom off, it's probably going to win you the game, or you're digging out from a really bad situation. And so this is a monster that has a lot of dig out built into the kit.
A real blaze of glory.
Absolutely. Speaking of glory, Zor Maxim, we made some very interesting changes to.
So picking up the power shadows on this one is a really interesting play. So it's got a lot of work with his teleport action. Mm-hmm. And Entropic Presence is something we've only ever seen, I think, on Gorgatron, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but denying enemy heals is really important for stopping opponents like Vimana, now Rex, now with his sacrifice. You know, being able to heal back breakpoints is something that's going to really change how the game plays out. So Zor Maxim denying, that's really big. And then also on top of the denial topic, though, Sealed Fate is going to be absolutely brutal. It's going to be really hard to be taking those tricky the low dice odds on Zor Maxim when you can't reroll them.
Yeah, and I think that's where maybe if you're playing into Zor Maxim, that dice efficiency becomes even more important, because you want to be saving those dice for your attacks into Zor Maxim, whereas you won't be able to be rerolling dice whether you have guard based tower or the world clock or any of the other rules that allow you to roll dice. That can really make or break a game for you when you're at that point at the crucial play and you want to be able to put as many dice into attacks as you want, as you need.
Most definitely. This monster saw changes kind of from various directions. Entropic Presence was something that we held off on specifically adding to the game, knowing that adding healing to the game when there was a bunch of monsters out there who all had healing effects would stifle their opportunity for greatness, right? But now was the opportunity for some of them to also have some counterbalances introduced. And only having one monster with Entropic Presence seemed like we could introduce it elsewhere. So introducing it to an alpha also means that a lot of the monsters who do heal all the monsters who do heal, heal back in their alpha form. And so this helps the kind of jousting of healing and health that can go on there. And then, like you had mentioned before, the interactions between shadows and teleport allow Zormaxim to both be really flexible within those lines of play of how they play together, but also it plays in that thematic, like we all work together, we all fight together. Zormaxim can teleport in a unit on one side and it can have focus will, and then on the other side shadows up a jam unit and be like, I'm blocked off on all sides by my team, can you come and open me up? And then he's still defense 9 going into defense 10 and hyper, very strong hyper that we added a anti-reroll to really solidify that this def 10 monster was not to be cracked easily, that you had to dedicate the resources to really can opener and get that work in there. And then shadows making it onto hyper as well to just keep that screening and working together motif going.
It's super thematic that the original ninja is the one who's the hardest monster is going to be to hit in the game.
Right? He's absolutely the sneaky ninja that is hard to get at and hard to pin down. So I'm going to talk about Zybanos a little bit. This was a change that we playtested so heavily and knew that from the get-go was going to take a lot of iterations to make sure we got it right. But Zybanos is one of the coolest models in the game. Big two-headed dragon, four arms, imposing to look at. But the model previously had a lot of rules that could be cool, could be interesting, but didn't necessarily amount to a whole lot. And so to bring in some of that wow factor, wrote the rule Dragonstorm, where basically this is the culmination of both being able to use the Draken units in concert, but also to get that really cool effect that just doesn't happen anywhere else in the game, that design space that just was untapped. And so with Dragonstorm, the headspace to think about it is that the first time one of your Draken units makes an attack, you get a refund for it. So in general, like that's just a great unit buff for a unit general. If the rule just read Draken units get a refund on that first attack, you'd probably still use that rule. The second time a Draken Armada unit destroys a unit, you can move an allied model. That can be a monster, that can be a unit. And so that can play in with Zybanos in the final stage of Dragonstorm. It can be screening or de-screening. It can be helping an allied monster or securing a building. So many different ways to use that extra movement. And then the third level of Dragonstorm is Zybanos gets to make an attack on your unit turn. And so it's using the dice in play. Your units don't have a ton of dice, which means that a bunch of your units, after having done all of the previous chains of Dragonstorm, are combining. So they're probably either attacking a monster or attacking a building so that you can get a lot of dice out of it and get a good return for it. But then Zybanos is going to make that action, which is usually not the most dice efficient thing to do, worth doing. And we see that theme through this packet quite a bit of units combining to make, you know, attacks, elites becoming relevant again to get those extra dice. And so here we have the Fusilier, who is great. Team tactics now can help raise that accuracy. You can run it in a pair with its elite and they can gun down something and then trigger Dragonstorm, and Zybanos can scoop up those dice and punch and get a demolisher punch or a hit and run punch. And then we added Omen, so that way the chain isn't just completely derailed by a single bad die roll. It also, he had an accuracy theme built into his card before, and so it kind of rolls all that in, all the accuracy and rerolling into this nice, neat, very short rule after that long Dragonstorm book that is there. But it's, you know, if your Draken Berserker goes in and it's the key one to get the Dragonstorm chain started, or it's the very last attack in the chain and it needs to happen, or if it's Zybanos's, you know, special attack that he makes, whatever it happens to be, Omen is the peanut butter that just makes it all smooth. And hyper troubleshoot is just that upgrade from Omen, so it made a lot of sense to take that straight line. With the addition of intimidate and explosion on its attacks, ultimate weapon is now super scary, and then both of those being relevant Dragonstorm triggers as well. The health split, we also added an extra speed and hyper. All of this together made Zybanos an interesting monster to think about, but an even more interesting monster to play on the table. It takes a couple games to kind of wrap your head around the fact that you're basically just playing regular Monpok, but if you need to really squeeze the juice out of a turn, Dragonstorm is there to go as deep and heavy into it as you want to lean. Now that I have ranted on about Zybanos, Shelley, would you like to tell us a little bit about Zybanos? Do you have anything you'd like to say?
Yeah, thinking about Dragonstorm can be a lot at first, but seeing it in play, it can be really awesome. Maybe not so much if you're on the receiving end of that. Sometimes it can be like, oh, is this building in the way? Maybe I can get this Dragonstorm to go off in order to open up this new line of attack. So it can really make for some different plays that you might not be necessarily expecting. And I think it's really interesting and fun, even if you're playing into it or putting it on the table yourself.
I can't tell you how many turns I've had saved by an Omen reroll, but I think Zybanos could be one of those monsters who's going to be like a real, real show of your display of skill. Between Ultimate Weapon and Dragonstorm, he's just got so many different ways to just really be like a true display of skill expression here.
Most definitely. The last game I played with Zybanos, I was in Alpha. I got the full Dragonstorm. And so for my second level of Dragonstorm movement, I move Zybanos closer to a building. And then I get the Dragonstorm attack and make my hit and run. And then hit and run further away, like so much Zoidberg, to the other side of this building and sat inside the pocket. And it felt really weird to move my monster that far on a monster turn. But if you think about it, we have things like Mount Terra and other ways to move monsters around. So it plays into those similar lines of being able to hide yourself on your unit turns. Well, Shelley, we finally made it to your favorite Destroyers monsters. And I know you're just itching to dive in. So why don't you tell us about the first one here?
Yeah, so first up we have Gallimaxus. So he didn't see too many changes as he's already pretty strong. Mm-hmm. Just a few small-ish updates. So his alpha and hyper health totals were swapped. So now he has a little bit more health to play with as far as the red line goes on his hyper. And then he gets an extra brawl attack by using destructive impulse. So he can smush even more units with what he's doing on his monster turns. So he's a really fast killing machine and there's a lot you can do with him. And I think it's really great that he has that extra health as far as redline goes.
On such a fast monster like Gallimaxus, destructive impulse can lead to some really, really disruptive turn ones. Being able to just swat a unit or kill a unit and then also destroy a building can be really, really, really raise some havoc in your opponent's power base.
Yeah, so he has a lot of options going for him. So it'll be exciting to see more people playing him.
Definitely. I think that adding the destructive impulse also gives the opportunity for that extra munch punch, which is pretty cool. And then I think the change in hyper was super key to the health total in that there was some lines of play where putting Gallimaxus into any kind of hyper that wasn't exactly on the hyper split meant that you probably just didn't get to use inner fire or overdrive because you couldn't afford the health. And so now it gives you a better split. Your breakpoints are a little different, and it gives you the opportunity to use that health. Plus, with Destructive Impulse, you can potentially hit a downtown high-rise and go back into Alpha.
Yeah, it opens up a lot of room for healing on him.
And then Munch Punch. All right, well, let's talk about Rogzor!
One of my beefy boys here. So Rogzor essentially just got Ignite. Yeah, he can light things on fire now on both sides of his card. And he did get a health upgrade as well. So as opposed to, I think he previously had 10 health, now he has 11. Mm-hmm. So that health increase really helps him to stay on the board longer, gives him more relevancy to the game. Whereas before, he was just kind of like waddling around and occasionally shooting buildings, but he's fun to play, but he wasn't where he should have been. And with these updates, I feel like it really will bring him back on the board, at least as far as I go. I'm really excited to play Rogzor with Tharsis and get some of those ignite repair interactions going off. And then speaking of those kinds of interactions as well with the updates to the Belchers, like we were talking about ignite with Scorchers before, if you have your Belchers splashing around with Rogzor as they should be, Rogzor can then ignite those rubble tiles as well. So I think, again, this will put a lot of those units and Rogzor back on the board and give a lot of fun lines of play.
Rob, do you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Rogzor is always one of those monsters that 10 health felt like he wasn't quite getting enough value out of his kit for it. So the 11 health spot is a real sweet spot for him now. And ignite's just sweet. It's really thematic for this big, you know, plasma fire going everywhere to be igniting stuff on fire.
Absolutely. I think it definitely plays into the themes and the faction. And then even furthermore, he's a big scorcher, basically just lighting things on fire. And with the Belchers, having that extra layer of synergy with Splash is nice. But honestly, like, he's got one of the best guns in the game, like in Hyper, Beatback, Devastation, Penetrator, you know, Speed 7. Rogzor was very passable before, but was lacking that little bit of synergy to tie it all together. It did lose Return Fire, and I have been asked about that quite a bit. And it does just make my life a little bit easier with there not being a Return Fire, Beatback, Devastation, Penetrator in the game. And that's your answer. So let's talk about Zavid, because of all the Destroyer monsters, this is the monster that saw the biggest glow up and, quite frankly, one of the scariest glow ups.
Yeah, so the little trash bot definitely got a little bit of a makeover here. So in Alpha, Lost Wrecking Crew, but that's not really what we're about here. He got spawning Locust Walker, so you can spawn both your Propo Walkers and as well as Baroda Walkers wherever Zavid goes. So this comes into play with the Baroda Walker buff that we talked about before. He picked up Thick Skin in Alpha, so he's a little bit more of a tank, as you would imagine Trashbot to be. And then he also gained Suplex, I think, is one of the most exciting changes. He used to only have Suplex in Hyper, but now you have those Suplex lines to add another level of complexity and really crack open some of those lines that your opponent really needs to be thinking about. He also gained Pile Driver as well, which gives him access to that super damage in Hyper, which he was really lacking. So with all of that combined, there's a lot of new lines for Zavod. He is still speed 5, but that's okay. We still love him. he can spawn out new things, and you can really flood the board with units between your spawning Locust and Baroda Walkers. So I'm really excited to see how those games go with units flooding the board whenever you have a Zavod on the board.
Yeah, he really feels like he's a walking factory now. Between the summon and the spawning Locust, he's really bringing his guys out everywhere he's going. And Suplex is one of my favorite rules. It's really, really interesting lines of play you can figure out with that rule.
Suplex is one of those things where you could spend a lot of time down the Suplex rabbit hole thinking about all the different ways to use it and still never use it. And then there are some games where you're like, oh, I'm thinking in Suplex brain now. I feel so big brain because you're just like, I Suplex to here and then I Suplex to here. It's a very feel good, feel cool rule. I think one of my favorite lines of play is the spawn Locust Walker on Zavid. Being able to drop the Verado Walker on your unit turn with spawning Locust and then have it beachhead out another unit and both be out wherever Zavid is super cool. Like, that line of play is just neat. And then that also means that, like, you don't necessarily need to use summon on your unit turns to screen yourself. There are ways to use it aggressively. You can summon in a unit and then you can transform it into, you know, a Toxo to be a hazardous unit or something for a reroll. And so there are opportunities abound when it comes to those new interactions. And then going into hyper and having suplex pile driver is just, it really makes this monster the king of the suplex, the king of the body slam.
Yeah, and queen. I think having access to super damage really helps Zavod in the late game, because I feel like that was something I was struggling with when playing Zavod previously, was that he just couldn't really keep up with the damage in the late game. So adding that super damage will really help him keep up with the damage trade.
Definitely. And breathe. Oh, we are finally through that monster of an update. And there was so much to talk about and so much we could have talked about, but I feel like we hit quite a bit.
You're always keeping us on our toes there, Frontier Press. So I can't wait to see what else is coming out in the future.
Yeah, and it's going to be an exciting year for 2023.
Oh, it most certainly will. Well, thank you both for being on. It was an absolute pleasure. We got to talk about a lot of great things. Feel free to join us. All three of us were always on the Discord, hanging out, talking about monsters, talking about lists, talking about units. Doesn't matter if you're brand new and it's your first game or you're just learning, we're there to help. And you can reach out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and follow Privateer Press's social medias on all of those. Join our social groups, participate, and join in on the fun. We'll see you next time. You want to say roll drums?
Roll drums.
Nice.